I know the whole area, the whole domain of depression itself is a huge presence within our society, and I don't claim to be any kind of an expert on the psychotherapeutic front, but I do know what, to some extent, painful mind states are like, and and, you know, the great difficulty which many people have in struggling with dealing with those states, not knowing what to do with a critical mind, a negative self-image, or feelings of sort of helplessness or worthlessness or meaninglessness. And that one of the things about mind states, particularly sort of heavy and confusing mind states, is that when the mind gets stuck in those, the very means whereby you develop any kind of clarity around them are hampered because everything's so cloudy. Sometimes, you know, like anger and desire are a lot more workable. The three fires, greed, hatred, and delusion, it's often pointed out that, you know, greed and hatred are really easy. They're kind of underlined three times in red and highlighted. They're easy to spot, but then delusion, deluded and dim and heavy, confused mind states are hard to work with because you're confused. You're not sure what's going on. You don't know what the rules are. You don't know what the game is. It's like, you know, when we have one of our wonderful fogs. No amount of blinking is going to make the fog dissipate. Or you turn the headlights off on your car and it just makes it even harder to see. You know, turn the lights up and it just reflects back even more fiercely from the fog. You can't see. So there are many, many challenges in trying to deal with these heavy and difficult mind states. And also another factor that there's a very wonderful little book, those here who might have experienced or are experiencing depression in various different ways, shapes, and forms. There's a wonderful little book by William Styron, the novelist, called Darkness Visible. And it's an account of his own experience of a sort of depressive collapse. He'd been a drinker for many, many years, and he'd just given up alcohol, and he was, thinking, in his early 60s at the time, and it just a series of other events pitched him into this enormous and depressive collapse. And in this book, Darkness Visible, he lays out an account of how he experienced this and how he worked with it. And it was very ironic. This was just at the time he'd been given some very, very prestigious literary award by the French, who don't hand out awards to foreigners very often. And so he was on his way to France to receive this wonderful accolade, and it was sort of as a writer, as a novelist, it was sort of, should be something that was incredibly pleasing and inspiring and delightful and definitely ego pampering. But he was so miserable, you know, he was in a dark state that it made it even worse, because there he was supposed to be being praised and loved by all these people and revered for his skill as a writer, but his world was just getting dimmer and heavier and grimmer. And in this book, he describes this whole process very clearly. One of the things, it's only a short book, about 60 or 80 pages. One of the things that really struck me that he pointed out was how ironic it is that the word depression is used to describe the state, because he says, you know, what's a depression? It's like a dent in the ground, you know, like a rut where a wheel has gone. It's something so innocuous and an absence. But he said, when I was in that state, it was far from being this sort of simple and innocuous absence, the experience was one of immense sort of energy and turbulence. He said, from the outside, when someone's very depressed, and they might sit in an armchair for hours, or just sort of sit by a window and just sort of stare blankly, and you think, oh, you know, Joe's really, really lost it, or Susie's really gone, you know, just become totally inert. And he said, well, the reason why you do that when you're in a depressed state, because the internal world is in such turmoil that you have to sort of freeze the outside, because of the disturbance inside is so strong, is such a kind of power. Now it's interesting. Now within Buddhist psychology, there's the Buddha addresses, he doesn't use a particular comparable term to depression as such, but there's a word, domanasa, which just means painful internal states, which encompass a lot of what we would tend to call depression and other similar psychological experiences. And the whole way that Buddhist meditation tries to work is rather than from an ideal position, it works from the reality of an experience as we know it, as we feel it. And one of the recognized causes of depression, I think even from the time of the Buddha, is thinking a lot. And as Ajahn Sumedho famously has said numerous times, the more I think about myself, the more depressed I get. I think it's probably true for all of us. That when we think about ourselves, and what we're often doing is we're comparing our felt reality, our felt sense of our own mind, our emotions, our nature, and we're comparing it to this ideal me, or me if I was feeling all right, or me, the me that I would like to be, or the me that the world expects me to be. And then we compare this felt me and the different mind states and attitudes and feelings with this idealized me, and quite unconsciously the experienced me is always way short of the perfect me, the idealized me. And so unconsciously we're often comparing everything that we say, everything that we do, and the events of our life and what we put effort into with this perfect me. Well, I shouldn't have said that. You know, the perfect me would have said something different, or I would have, you know, the perfect me would have succeeded at this, or the perfect me would be kind of loved by this person and that person, and the perfect me would never have got fired from that job. I mean, we don't spell it out that way, because if we did, it wouldn't really work. But because it's sort of blurry, confused states, and we don't see it clearly, we don't realize those comparisons are going on. So a lot of what feeds those sort of negative mind states, the sort of the domanasa quality, this sort of depressed, heavy, pressured sort of inner turbulence that can bring us to very negative self-image and a burdened and pressured quality within us, is just this simple habit of thinking a lot about ourselves and believing our thoughts. And we don't realize that we actually have a choice to do this. We can, on the one hand, we can do some, we can make some efforts to learn how not to think so much, but which takes a bit of doing. But as a first step, and as initial, and maybe even the most important step, we can train ourselves not to believe our thoughts, not to believe that every judgment that the mind makes. Because as I saw in a bumper sticker in Mendocino only a couple of weeks ago, just because you think it doesn't mean it's true. Well, maybe a more useful bumper sticker would be, just because I think it doesn't mean it's true. And so that so much of the useful ways of dealing with negative mind states, and in a way is embodied in that little kind of a guided meditation that I was leading, is that sense of taking everything in, being able to listen to what your mind creates, and having that little sort of filter of knowing, this is a mind state, this is an attitude, this is my mind saying, I shouldn't have done that, I should have said something different, oh God, what will they think of me, oh dear, I've done it again, why am I so weak, why am I so stupid, and this is failing again, or this is all hopeless. We believe those judgments, don't we? We assume, because it's going on in my mind, it's an accurate representation of reality. This is absurd. Really, I mean, I would suggest, humbly, or not very humbly. Yeah, it's but we're so used to it that we think, what does he mean? I mean, of course, why shouldn't it be true? You know, I mean, most of what I think is true, really. But again, Ajahn Sumedho would often say such memorable things as, all your thoughts are garbage. And I remember years ago, back in the 80s, that on a winter retreat at Amravati, and he was sort of paused for a moment during giving a Dharma talk, and he was talking about the fallibility of thinking, and then he just said, well, actually, all your thoughts are garbage. And part of me was offended. I mean, some of my thoughts were very good. You know. But it was interesting, because instantaneous or simultaneous with that thought of, what do you mean? Well, that's not quite it, really. There was a sense of relief in the heart that says, oh. That's true, really. And it's an unburdening of the heart, because we take all our thoughts so seriously. We don't realize that a lot of them conflict with each other. And so what makes the heart into such a wonderful filter is it provides that space around every thought, every attitude, every feeling that is able to ask, is that so? Is that really true? Is that the whole story? Yes, you know, you tried at this and it didn't work out, but you know, is that the end of the world? Is that, you know, is it likely that you're going to succeed at every single task as possible? Does that mean that you're, just because this thing that you undertook didn't work out, does that mean that you're a bad person? Really? And that quality of receptivity, that taking things in and knowing them, this is a thought, this is a mood, this is a feeling, this is a mind going on its own critical trip. This is the inner tyrant doing its job. You know, there she goes again. She's an inner critic. She's supposed to say these things. That's the way it is. Then there's a listening, there's a spaciousness around that. It's known as a mental pattern, an event happening within us. And that is the transforming element. A year or so ago, I was a part of a fortunate indeed to be part of a conference with a bunch of mind scientists, neurologists and psychologists and such like, with the Dalai Lama in Washington, D.C. And one of the people that was present, giving a presentation, was a fellow called Zindel Siegel. And it's kind of interesting, because when I met him, I thought he was he seemed a very somber and sort of sad and depressive type. Very, not very expressive and outgoing and kind of ebullient. And then as I got to know him, I realized actually he was quite he was very sweet-natured. And interestingly enough, his field was mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. That's a kind of fancy way. And it's actually very similar to Buddhist meditation, whereby cognitive therapy is, as probably most of you know, there might even be a few cognitive therapists in the room. Excuse me if I'm getting this wrong. It's this very art of learning to listen to our thoughts and training ourselves not to believe them. Just recognizing this is a pattern of thought. This is the way the mind likes to think. When this happens, it goes off on this trip. This is its script. It likes to say this. And usually these are sort of negative patterns or critical, harmful patterns. And the point of cognitive therapy is that you can recognize it as a pattern and you can change the pattern. That through attentiveness, you know, you're listening, you're paying attention to what the patterns are, and you're making a choice to think differently. And to recognize, if this is believed in, this is going to be painful. Recognizing it's just a pattern, recognizing we can think differently, recognizing there's a different perspective on situations. And so that, and Zindel and his partners, he works in Toronto, have been developing this whole system of therapy based around this kind of listening to our thoughts and mindfulness meditation. And using that to work with depression. Now, I know that certain kinds of depression are very chemically based and physically based. But even so, my understanding, talking with the scientists and therapists and my own sort of experience in this area, is that even if it is a biologically based depression, that it's still the case. We still have the mental faculties to establish a distance from it. And that the more that we're able to rouse that ability to listen to the content of the mind and to employ that faculty that we have to not believe, and to also, along with that, to develop a mindfulness of the physical sensations, because along with the mental element, there's a whole body sense that goes with negative feelings. It'll take different forms for different people in different situations. But in exactly the same way, when there's a strong depressive mood, or the mind is really caught up with that, and the attention wants to get stuck into some really wonderful, miserable rut. It's magnetized towards that obsessive rumination about how terrible and useless I am and the world is. To be able to exercise the ability to bring the attention, to say, even if that's true, how does it feel in the body? Where does where is that experience felt? So part of that, the cloud, the acrid cloud of smoke that we can kind of breathe in, is also just the physical senses that come, the qualities that are there with negative mind states, and the feelings of heaviness or constriction or discomfort. Just to know, this is the physical sensation that comes with a depressive feeling, with dark feelings, with negative feelings and attitudes. It feels like this. And we begin to notice that the more simply that we chunk it, the more that we're just looking at the raw experience of this moment, this particular pattern of thought, this particular physical sensation, right now it's like this. And we're not trying to make it pleasant or pretending that it's pleasant or that it's not like a heavy feeling or a constrictive feeling or just like an ache in the heart. Sometimes that sadness and grief and so forth. It's like an aching in the chest, or like sometimes people feel like a sort of spear through the chest, a sort of intense pressure in the heart. The amazing and strange thing is that even some kind of very pointed and difficult feeling like that, when we bring the attention to it, we really let the feeling of it, the sensation of it, be fully known. Something in the heart realizes, this is just a painful feeling in the heart. It's not nice, it's not likable, we wouldn't choose it, but actually it's just a feeling. And even though the thinking mind goes and doesn't want to acknowledge that, when we really bring it into focus and we let it be known, something in the heart recognizes, that is the fact. This is miserable, it's uncomfortable, but it is just a feeling. And in that moment, there's a quality of release and relief. that there's the turbulence, there's the sort of infernal storm, or that kind of intensity of feeling, a painful feeling. But there's a sense of the space around it, the space within it. There's an unburdenedness there too. So that the along with working with negative feelings within ourselves, and you know, things that that come up, you know, from particular events in our life or particular things that we've done or particular aspects of our nature, of it's nothing that we can kind of pin it on. And again, I don't want to sort of counteract therapy or negate the fact that it's sort of useful. It can be, you know, the talking cure can cure. But sometimes just getting having a verbal approach and trying to just, you know, think your way to a quality of clarity and peacefulness, trying to sort it out, even though that's a well-intended effort, sometimes the more we try and think about it, the more we use the sort of calculating and pattern-seeking qualities of the mind, the more complicated it gets, and we create a more and more dense and intricate, complicated self-image, and you have, you know, more and more intricate and complicated depression. And so oftentimes just that reducing the whole experience as much as can be done to the pattern of this moment, not trying to figure out a whole complicated image of who and what we are, but just recognizing in this moment the mind is saying this is a pattern of thinking, may be true, may not be true, but right now it's this. Because we worship thinking so much, we worship the capacity of conceptual thought and words to explain everything, and we take refuge in explanation. I speak as a compulsive explainer, one who loves making lists and drawing diagrams and having everything figured out and all in kind of the right order. You know, I personally love that. You know, it's a kind of Virgoan trait. Nothing better than a good list to keep the world in order. But there's only so much that we can do, and that the satisfaction or the quality of wholeness that comes from that can only be partial. So similarly, when we try to keep it simple and use the realism of that as our pattern of approach, we find that can genuinely help on an internal level. And then when it comes to world events, I think probably just since it's a world, you know, world events twinned with the subject of depression, it was when we put world events in the title of this evening's theme, it was not sort of cheerful world events necessarily, but more kind of the troubles of the world is what's implied. When we think about all the ailments of the world and all of the injustices and afflictions around the planet, then it's totally natural to get depressed, because we have global communications, massive amounts of information about countries that 100 years we never even knew existed. And now we have sort of minute-by-minute reports. You can sort of tap into Reuters and get up-to-the-minute reports on every injustice and, you know, all 210 of the countries in the UN. So we can be flooded with information about painful experiences and difficulties. And so that when the mind, in a similar way, tries to figure it all out or hold it all together or gather it, in a conceptual way, we just become overwhelmed. It's just too much to do. It's too burdensome. And so then the feelings of powerlessness are accentuated. I mean, just saying these words, right? You know, we feel more depressed, right? Just in the last 3 minutes since I started talking about work, didn't we all just start feeling worse? I did, and I was saying it, you know, right? that's how it works. You know, we bring it all into attention and we feel a lot worse. So it's not a matter of just ignoring things, but recognizing that when we approach the world and life in the world and the suffering of the world from like an idealistic point of view, like in a perfect world I would be able to make everything all right for everybody and all beings, you know, all over the planet, and I would stop all suffering everywhere, and so then I can't, so therefore I'm falling short. As I've said a number of times, I used to, when I was a teenager, I used to suffer immensely over never being able to do enough. No matter how hard you tried or what you did, you just couldn't help others enough. There was always something you couldn't do. You had a limitation on your ability to really help others and really relieve things or get things right. There was always more that could have been done. And my mind would always ignore the stuff that I had done or ways that people had been helped. I would focus just on how short I'd fallen or how others were still suffering regardless. One of the things that I feel is a really important lesson that we need to learn, how we can handle the sufferings of the world, and the way we can hold that and attend to that, attune to that in a skillful way, is what I experienced when I first went to Asia and was living in Thailand. What was really after I started to get familiar with the culture and just talking with people and getting a sense of people's attitudes, what really amazed me was that you're living in a Buddhist monastery, so you're running across good-hearted people, and they're, you know, nobly intended, and that it was clear that people were happy to give and happy to help and to do what they could to assist and lend a hand, but what they couldn't do, they didn't suffer about. And at first, I it was like I couldn't quite. There wasn't really a place in my mind for that. It's like, no, you know, the things that you can't do, you have to feel bad about it. I mean, you must. And then it was like there was a, like Thai language, you have five different tones, and they hear tones just like we hear consonants and vowels. So to a Thai ear, the word cow is very different from cow. Or cow. One means nine, one means white, one means mountain, one means rice. Another one means enter. Five different tones. And they would hear that as differently as we would hear now, vow, wow. And so at first you can't hear the tones. You think, well, it's just cow, cow, cow. It's a lot of different cows. You know? They're all the same cow. You know? One, seen one cow, you've seen them all. You know? Heard one cow, you've heard them all. So there kind of wasn't really a place in my consciousness for that. And I began to see over and over that's amazing. They do what they can, and what they can't do, they don't suffer about. They're not glad that other people are still not being helped, but they don't make a problem out of it. They're not excusing themselves or beating themselves up or anguishing over that. They do what they can, and the rest they leave alone. They don't suffer about. Wow, what a concept! So in a sense of the polarities that we tend to feel with, like, feeling we should fully attend to all the suffering in the world and we should do everything we can, and then feeling overwhelmed and burdened by that, then the polarity, the other end of the polarity is then we just sort of shut down and say, I just don't want to know, I can't bear it, I can't deal with it, and we just wall ourselves off. So that if we really want to live in an effective and fully spiritual manner, then there needs to be an openness, but also just recognizing and training ourselves to be at ease with that capacity. What our capacity is, just doing what we can do, and the rest, again, mostly by tracking our patterns of thinking, just that the mind that says, you could be doing more, you should be doing more, why aren't you doing enough? There are still people suffering, it's all your fault, you know, you should do more, you should try harder, you should give more. Just to be able to listen to that voice and say, Thank you for sharing. This is the job of the inner tyrant, and he's supposed to say these things. So thank you. You've done your duty. But now, you know, I need some time off. So I'm going to take a nap. Or whatever it might be. Just giving ourselves that space. And I think I've told here a number of times this story of a very significant incident that took place out on 10 Mile Beach. As two friends were walking along 10 Mile Beach, and it was after a big storm, and millions, thousands and thousands, millions of sand dollars, living sand dollars, had been washed up on the shore. And maybe these two people are here this evening. Anyway, so these two friends were walking along, and they were having a conversation, and one was getting really annoyed with the other because she kept bending down and picking up these sand dollars and throwing them into the sea, which of course interrupted the walk. And so there's like millions of these things all over the beach. These are these flat, they're like sea urchins, but they're squashed. And so as they were walking on, one friend was getting more and more annoyed. She said, look, there are countless sand dollars on this beach. And you know, we're trying to have a conversation. So it's just really annoying. You keep bending down and picking these things up and throwing them in the sea. I mean, face it, it really doesn't make a difference. I mean, you're not going to make any difference, really. I mean, there's like millions of them. And then she said, makes a difference to this one. That is really insightful. So I think we all need to learn from the wisdom of the sand dollar, the flying sand dollar. That it makes a difference to that one. So when the mind says, well, you can't do enough, or if only I could do more, it's just that, to that one sand dollar, happy day. That was a good day. There was the misery of being washed up on the beach and stuck there, and then there was that strange flying experience, and then splash, hooray! Back home again. So just having, when we reflect on the sufferings of the world and wishing to help, and it's necessary, appropriate for us to sort of take that in and feel it, to know it, reflect on it, and then to respond to that by what we can do, and then seeing that, yeah, that little bit helps. Just for that one sand dollar, it made a difference. And then the rest, let go of. There's no need to beat ourselves up or suffer over all the sand dollars that are still on the beach. You know, and that's hard for us to do, but I feel that if we can learn that kind of lesson, and I repeat these kind of themes over and over because it's so helpful, so important for us. And that, because if we just buy into the negative state and try to, we end up exhausting ourselves trying to deal with all of the every sand dollar on the beach and drive ourselves nuts and get agitated and confused, or we just shut the whole thing out and just harden the heart. And neither of those ever really work. But to find this place where we are able to be open to the painfulness that beings experience, and to do what we can, then when you really bring your attention to the heart and notice, there's a feeling of completeness. Even though there's still a billion beings that need help, and the beach is covered with sand dollars, there's still a completeness within us. We know in this moment we've done what can be done, and that's perfect too. Our life is complete, and hasn't been wasted. So I offer these thoughts for consideration, and we'd like to open things up for any reflections people have. Also, if Ajahn Mehta or any of the others would like to offer anything, have any comments to make, please. Any questions or Cheryl? Yeah.
National conference on homeless children, and she does that work locally, and she said she came back and she was completely overwhelmed. You know, I think it was 1.2 million children in the United States are homeless, and most of those children are under the age of 5, and that she was sort of paralyzed with that. I picked her up at the airport and we were driving back, and during the course of the conversation she said that what's so interesting is that when she works with just her kids here, she doesn't feel overwhelmed at all. And I said, that's part of the answer. That you do, that's just what you were saying. You do what you can do, and that's what you can do. And it's hard to keep that global sense of awareness and balance that with what's attainable here. And I so appreciate that story that you told about in Asia, about that different mindset. And I remember that there was some little piece of that that you didn't mention tonight, because it seems like there isn't guilt in that culture. And I think you articulated that once before in that story, that someone sort of said, well, when you ask them, how do you not help those people, but you help these people? And they sort of said, well, you know the story because you were there. You know, well, of course, I just do this and I don't worry about that, or I can't help that. And somehow the guilt issue factors into our psychology and psyche in a way that it doesn't in other cultures, and I think that's part of what torments us. That we ought to be doing more. So that's it.
Thank you.
I feel like when I listen to you, I feel another aspect that shines also light exactly on this point is that we are so geared on that we have to do it all ourselves. It's all us solving it. What we are not in contact with is the trust that also there are other forces who help solving problems. And also, I think it's also the aspect of ego coming into that. It's like we are so trained that how to say, in presenting ourselves and presenting and living that aspect, even so, and forgetting that it is not true, that we are what we are and we can only do what we can do, and all the rest is just an illusion. It's not reality. And kind of punishing ourselves with what we are not and pretending or imagining we should be all that when we are not. And kind of really coming back to reality. And this is what came out of that story with throwing the animal?
Sand dog.
Yeah. I don't know. Is it an animal?
It's like a sea urchin.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And the shell, usually you find it's the shells.
Yeah.
And they're very flat and white, and they're round.
Yeah.
So they look like a dollar, an old dollar coin.
Uh-huh.
So they're called sand dollars because you find them on the sand on the beach. But these were live ones. And they're little,
yeah. So they're little animals.
They're little animals, like shellfish.
Yeah. So, like, that story shows it very clearly that, yes, it does matter what we are doing. It doesn't mean that we have to solve the whole world. We can't. Just the thought of, I feel like just the thought of I have to shows like the illusion that comes in, the illusion of the ego that even just thinks I should do more than I can. And I find that for myself and for my own practice also very helpful that, so what? I do what I can. Okay. Yeah, I hope it makes clear what I mean. It's kind of that ego trigger is that we really have to learn to recognize and to what we also like to do, and the joy of helping it, generosity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Could you comment on the maybe possible values of doing that work, that internal work in community, as opposed to seemingly doing it by yourself?
Well, it's like living, when you live in community, it's like having 12 therapists. I hadn't quite thought of it like that before, but because I mean, just like a person working with a single therapist, and a therapist might say, well, you know, did you notice what you just said, or when you say that, what's going on internally? Then when you live in a community, I mean, I lived in community for nearly 30 years, and, you know, the other people here have done so for long periods of time. And, you know, but not just living in community, but a meditative group. And so what you have is a situation where you're paying close attention to each other. And your mind states are being reflected in the people that you live with. And so because you're most of what's going on is you're paying attention to each other and your life together and trying to harmonize, then just the even minor fluctuations of your attitude, your feelings, your moods, and that of others, you know, they're reflecting your mind states and you're reflecting their mind states. So that you have, all, in a way, why I say it's like living with 12 therapists, is you've got all these different mirrors reflecting back to you different parts of your nature. So, say, Ajahn Mehta, I've known her for about 15 years. When I lived at Amaravati Monastery, and she first came there as a lay guest and stayed there. And then, I would be one of the monks there at Amaravati, and she would be a lay guest, and then she joined the nuns community. So then, me connecting with the nuns, then as a, or, you know, or her as a lay woman, you know, many years ago, then that reflects certain aspects of my character, how I would relate to that person as a new student or someone who doesn't know much about meditation, just getting familiar with Buddhist tradition. Then, so there's one set of roles I have to play, and that's reflected back by that person. Then, you know, 3 seconds later, there's another sort of fellow monk who's senior to you, and, you know, but he's been around even longer, and you're kind of a less experienced person than them. So then you get a whole different set of qualities mirrored back, and then here you have people just dropped into the day who are asking about different aspects of Buddhism. So you're having to you know, relate closely with a whole variety of different people. And if you're paying attention, you see all these different aspects of your own character coming up and then being reflected back to you, so that you're noticing, I really don't like this situation. I'm looking for a way to get out of this. I'm waiting for this conversation to be over as quickly as possible. Or, I really like this. This is great. This is my favorite. Or, oh dear, I'm in charge. What are they going to think of me? Or whatever. You see, because of living in a meditative community, you're noticing those and learning from them. So it's a tremendously rich way of studying your own mind, because you're not just in one mode, but you're learning to see yourself as a student, as a teacher, as a leader, as a follower, as a, you know, all these different modes. As a man to women, as a man to other men, or a woman to a woman. You know, so that all of those different dynamics bring forth different aspects of your own character, so you really get a full on, a total immersion exploration of these different habits and traits and qualities. What would you say, Ajahn?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not the same experience. And it's quite interesting, really, to see how fast that can change. I find, I mean, what comes to mind when I listen to you teaching situation, like teaching a retreat. Like say for a weekend, we have a retreat center at Amaravati. So I stay in the same monastery. I go to the retreat center, teach a retreat, kind of be the teacher, and then come back to the community. Kind of, then the whole situation changes around. But I find it very helpful because there's no chance to, or not a lot of chance to develop a certain kind of identification with the role.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you do this and for that, that is the conditioning for that. Then you go into a different situation, completely different conditioning, and so another aspect of self comes out. And in that way, it really helps to get going. Basically, and not taking it so serious.
Is that helpful?
It was helpful, but I had a totally different question in mind.
Ah, okay.
I think I didn't express it well. And I've been involved in doing the coming back to life work, the Joanna Macy work that works with overcoming despair mm-hmm. of the world situation. And it's done in community as opposed to doing it individually on a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very similar. The processes are very similar. But instead of doing it with your mouth shut, you do it with your mouth uh-huh. open. And other people are witness to that and you're witness to theirs.
That's basically what we've done. That's living in monastic community. Okay. So she wrote that book, Despair and Empowerment in the Nuclear World, is that right?
Yes, there's another one called Coming Back to Life, the work that reconnects, and it's a compilation of 30 years of workshops that she gave on overcoming despair with the Buddhist faith, but kind of a New Age psychological format.
Well, it's because in our monasteries, you know, oftentimes people think that monastery life is, you know, you're spending all your time in silence, doing sort of sitting and walking meditation. But it's very communal. I mean, you are deeply conscious of the people that you live with. Larry is an ex-monastic. For a year, chuckling in the front row. You become very, very conscious of the people that you live with, and exactly that kind of what we were describing really is, you know, you hear out of the mouths of the people that you live with, because you have to, it's very frequently observed that you, in a monastery you end up living with people that you would never have chosen as your friends. But because you have a common experience or love of the Dharma teachings and you want to, you know, have a similar attraction towards a sort of full-on involvement in spiritual training, then you have that fellowship, that commonality. But boy, the personality is different. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. At times, there's a lot of experience, but that's good because you get perspectives on your own attachments and biases that you would never get when you choose or you only live with people you would choose. It's like the family. Yeah. How many of us would have chosen the siblings that we ended up with? Yeah, or still can't understand them 50 years later. Bernie, yeah.
Well, I'm wondering about your statement that all thoughts are garbage. Because, I mean, maybe you don't really mean that, but I mean, if all thoughts are garbage and everything that you said tonight arose from things that you thought about, then why should we take anything seriously that you said, or, you know, why take anything seriously?
Good point. But, you know, any kind of statement like that, like any analogy, you know, it's partial. It can only... and it's like a medicine I found that particular statement was the exactly appropriate medicine for the certain attitudes that I had. That because of tending to take all of our thoughts so seriously, that you can see, well, actually, you know, a thought can only, it can't be anything other than a half truth. And the Buddha said as much in Pali. It's yena yena hi manyanti tatatang hoti anyatati, which means no matter what we conceive it to be, the truth is always other than that. That is a universal law. Even like philosophers and particle physicists and mathematicians will tell you the same thing. You know, when you try to really define what any one thing is, you can't do it. I was reading a little while ago, I've been reading a few math books recently, and this fellow pointed out that in this huge mathematical treatise that was done in the early part of the 20th century by Alfred North Whitehead, who incidentally was the sort of founder of systems theory. Alfred North Whitehead and Bertrand Russell, they did this whole collection of books on mathematics, trying to establish all the rules of mathematics from first principles. It takes them 315 pages to define the number one. And in the introduction, Whitehead says, like, well, when you talk about things like whales, it's really easy. It's like, here's a whale, you know, here's two whales, here's three whales. Like, and there's no argument about that. But when you're trying to actually say what threeness is, you know, when you try to pin it down and get close, you can't fix it. So in that respect, then, you know, all thoughts are garbage. You know, all concepts are partial. But they're useful. And they're half-truths, but they're useful half-truths. They're convenient fictions. You know, like we say, second Wednesday of the month, you know, we'll have the monastics will come to Yomo. You know, that you can say, well, ultimately there is no Wednesday. Wednesdays are just, you know, concepts in the mind, but that actually it's only dependent on the turning of the planet Earth in this particular solar system. Yeah, right, but, you know, second Wednesday of the month, come to Yomo. So, when you have that context for thought, that fundamentally, you know, none of them can be absolutely true, what you're doing is you're just creating that little bit of an edge that is giving some room around all of our favorite truths and all of the familiar stories, things that we never question, and that just I find when you bring that suggestion in, that this can only be a partial truth, it can't be the whole story, as soon as that's apparent, I feel a quality of relief, like something in the heart goes, oh, yeah, right, it might be true in terms of conventional reality, today is Wednesday. But, you know, that's only one kind of a calendar. You know, in terms of the lunar calendar, we are on the, where are we now, Wednesday? We're the fifth day of the waxing moon. Friday is the new moon. So it's actually Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Fifth day of the waxing moon. How many of us knew that? You could see a kind of banana moon hanging in the sky. Because we're not used to a lunar calendar, but a couple of hundred years ago, or at least, you know, 50 years ago in Thailand, that's how you wouldn't have said Wednesday. We didn't have Wednesdays. Could it be the fifth day of the waxing moon? 12th month. So it's just a way of loosening up the fixity of our thinking, and that's the I find is a miracle of Dharma teachings. And the Buddha said this is actually the different kinds of miracle. There's the miracle of psychic power, and there's the miracle of instruction. You know, and there's the two kinds of miracle. the miracle of instruction is the greater. How it's amazing how by weaving together conventional truths and symbolic vocal noises, we can actually bring about changes within ourselves that are of a profoundly radical nature. Yeah, people have even been kind of totally enlightened listening to Dharma talks. I mean, maybe it's happened to see. Or not. But that's amazing. Yeah, you're using conventional truths to awaken to the ultimate truth. Incredible, but it works. Yeah. You have anything to add? Or? Yeah, one more.
I want to comment a question. The teaching of turning the other cheek. Mm-hmm. It's a Jesus teaching that if somebody slaps you on this cheek, you turn the other cheek. Mm-hmm. And I want to compare that to a Buddha story that I heard of. A Buddhist monk was in the forest, and an American tank in Vietnam, an American tank came along, and the American soldier got on top of the tank and spit on the head of the monk. And the monk was ready to, he got so angry, he was ready to give up his robes and everything and become a fighter against the Americans. And instead of his teacher saying, turn the other cheek, the teacher, they sort of embraced him and taught him compassion to try to understand a bit of that this American soldier was a victim also. And to me that makes more sense than turning the other cheek. Is there any sort of do you have any comments about that?
I hadn't heard that second story before, in a way, I feel that they're touching the same place, because what with turning the other cheek, what you're doing is you're refusing to buy into the value system of the person who's just attacked you. You're refusing to be afraid, and what you're doing is that you're saying, "I'm not going to buy into your aggressive action. That's your choice. You want to follow that? That's your business. I'm not going to pick it up." And not because I'm trying to be better than you, or one-up you, but because that wouldn't be a kindness to you or to myself. And it's like responding to that in the person which is not caught up in those aggressive urges, and not bound by that sort of position taking and so forth. So that I think the advice that the monk got was not to fight back, but to recognize that the person is also suffering. It's just that I would say is exactly what there is in the turning the other cheek. That you're saying, well, yes, you've just attacked me, but if you really want to do that, if that will make you happy, please have some more. And then the person, because they're not being opposed in the way that they expect, the part of them that is deeper and more true is being touched. I mean, I know many stories like that where had one monk in our community was attacked by bandits in India, and he was walking through a forest, and they had sort of captured him and his partner, and they were threatening to kill him. He had they'd been cutting wood in the forest, and had these axes and wooden staves. And the layman who was with this monk had been kind of fighting and struggling, trying to get away, and so he'd been contending against them, and they sort of caught up with him and, anyway, and captured him. And then they were making these sort of aggressive gestures to the monk, kind of threatening him with the axe, and he just put his hands together and put his head down and said, "You want my head? Please take my head." And he even got a bit cheeky, because this guy was literally holding the axe over his head, and this was Ajahn Sujito. He even got a little bit cheeky. He kind of drew a line on the top of his head saying, "Here, you know, strike here." And the guy couldn't bring the axe down because he'd offered his head. He says, "If you want to kill me, you know, fine." And he started chanting, you know, "Namo Tassa Bhagavato." And because that gesture then it touched that place in the person. "I'm not going to respond to your, I'm not going to defend my property, you know, anything that you want of mine you can have. I'm not even going to defend my life. I'm a monk, I don't fight. So if you want to take my life, have it." And then he was physically incapable of bringing the axe down. So it was almost like he was kind of, part of him was trying to do it, but part of him just wouldn't do it. His own heart, his own true nature wouldn't let him bring the axe down. And so it was because Ajahn Sujito realized that if he'd struggled, he would have been dead. If he fought back. But it wasn't just so that it was a ruse, kind of a trick to stay alive. But he was, "Okay, this is it. Game over. I better get ready. Kudan saranam gacchami." And so they duly took everything from him. And they didn't harm him. He came out without a scratch. But they took his robes and they left him with his sarong, thankfully, and his sandals, and they took everything else. And then when they got back to Nalanda, they so many people heard about the story of them being robbed that within a few days they had more stuff given to them than they had when they set out through the forest. More things were given to help them. So the important thing is that refusal to buy into the value system of the other, and it touches something in us that's very powerful. Like one of the biggest voices in prison reform in Britain is a guy called Jimmy Boyle, who was a Glasgow gang fighter. And he was in jail for a couple of murders that he said he didn't commit. But he was known as a very, very violent prisoner, uncontrollable. And so they set up this particular unit, I think in Barlinnie Prison in Glasgow. And it was a hyper-secure unit within this maximum security prison. But inside this unit, it was a very open situation. It was totally watertight situation, and there was no mixing with ordinary prisoners, and there was a few prisoners living within this sort of central compound, and this guy Jimmy Boyle was part of that. And they are having this experiment whereby the guards and the staff were treating these prisoners very pointedly on a very human level, because they were incorrigible, like fighting each other, fighting the guards. And so on this particular occasion, Jimmy Boyle, he'd been sent a parcel, and there's nothing around whatsoever that they can use as weapons. And these are guys who attacked and knifed guards and stuff like numerous times. And this guard gave him a pair of scissors, pointed scissors, to open the parcel with. And then Jimmy Boyle looked at it and said, "You're giving me the scissors." And the guard says, "Yes." "You know what I can do with them?" He says, "Yes, I know exactly what you can do with them." And he said, he looked at the scissors and he looked at the guard. And then this thing just kind of erupted in him, like, he trusts me. And part of him was like, "Well, what an idiot." And then he just decided he wouldn't listen to that voice, and he took the scissors and he opened the parcel and gave the scissors back to the guard. And then his whole life started taking a turnaround from there. He got out of jail. He actually married his barrister. His wife, as well as a woman. And he ended up marrying her. And he has this whole program involved in prison work called Inside Out. You know, helping people in prisons. And he runs a fine wine import business in Scotland now. He's a totally different character. And very, very active and very effective in prison reform. And it was from that, the guard, making that gesture of, I know you're the hardest man in this prison. You're the toughest guy. And I'm putting a weapon in your hand. You know, I'm not going to buy the fact that you're the hard man. And that's all there is to you, that this guy Jimmy Boyle is just evil and hard and violent to the core. No, I know that's not true. And then that gesture drew that forth. So that's probably a nice, good note for inspiring them rather than any other depressing note for the evening. So we can close it there. Maybe we'll just finish with a sharing of blessings. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides on great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life, may they soon attain the threefold bliss, and realize the deathless, through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord, the Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.